Please remain standing just for the scripture reading.
Today's reading is from 1 Samuel 22, 1-5. That's the New King James Version. 1 Samuel 22. David therefore departed from there and escaped to the cave of Adullam. So when his brothers and his father's house heard it, they went down there to him. And everyone who was in distress, everyone who was in debt, and everyone who was discontented gathered to him. So he became captain over them, and there were about 400 men with him. Then David went from there to Mizpah of Moab, and he said to the king of Moab, "Please let my father and mother come here with you till I know what God will do for me." So he brought them before the king of Moab, and they dwelt with him all the time that David was in the stronghold. Now the prophet Gad said to David, "Do not stay in the stronghold. Depart and go to the land of Judah." So David departed and went into the forest of Herith. You may be seated.
All right. Well, glad that you're here today. Thank you for coming. And for those who may be your first time here, we've been going through the life of David. And so this is, if this is your first time here, or maybe you've been away for a while, it's good to see you guys back. Welcome back. But if you've been away for a while, if you this is your first time here, let me encourage you to go online and listen to the series on David. I think it'll be an encouragement to you. And we'll just do a bit of a recap here this morning. But we're looking at the early years of David. And today we've got the title of our message, The Cave Dwellers Only. And you'll find out why in just a moment here. But if you remember the story we brought up to this point, Saul was king at this time, and he disobeyed God. And as a result of that, God began to look for another king. And Samuel went on the hunt for this new king. And as a result of that, we find that David was chosen of God at a very young age. But nothing seemed to happen. Samuel came and anointed him as king, but he just continued to be the shepherd boy that he's always been. One day he was out delivering a care package to his brothers because of his dad wanted him to go out and deliver this care package. And they were on the battlefield, and there was Goliath, and he heard Goliath talking smack about his God. And he's like looking around saying, hey, is there not a cause? What's going on here? Why are we allowing this guy to do this?" As you see all the soldiers go and they run to their tent because they're afraid. And then while he was there, his brother was fussing at him. But then he defeated Goliath with a sling and a stone. And then after that, God began to move him up in the ranks. And he became the armor bearer for Saul. And he began to lead a regiment of men. And he became very important. The people were singing his praises. But then, unfortunately, Saul got a little bit jealous. And with jealousy happens in his life, things just started going from bad to worse. And then, instead of looking at all of God's enemies as his enemies, he began to look at David as his enemy. And he started to kill David. And he wanted to find opportunities to put him to death. And so now David has been on the run. He's kind of like a fugitive, if you will, but he's done nothing wrong. And so this is where we're up into the point right now where David, he has hit rock bottom. He's in a downward spiral. He's lost his job. He's lost his wife. He's lost his home. He's lost his counselor, his closest friend, his notoriety. His people were singing his praises, and now we don't see David anymore. And now finally, as we've seen the last time we met on this particular topic, he lost his self-respect. When we left him, David was drooling saliva down his beard and scratching on the enemy's gate like a madman. Realizing that his identity was known to the Philistines, he pretended to be an insane man. And this was his way that he could then slip out of the city of Gath. And once more, we see that he's a man on the run. In 1 Samuel chapter 22, verse 1, it says, "Therefore David departed from there and escaped to the cave of Adullam. So when his brothers and all of his father's house heard it, they went down there with him." So let's talk about the cave here this morning, how it happened. This was the lowest moment of David's life to date. And if you want to know how bad he really was and how bad he really felt, all you have to do is look through the Psalms that he composed, the songs, and we see this in Psalm 142. He had no security, he had no food, no one to talk to, no promise to cling to, and no hope that anything would ever change. He was all alone in a dark cave, away from everything and everybody that he loved. Everybody except for God. He had come to a place where all of his crutches had been removed. Everything that he was leaning on, everything that he put his hope and trust in, they were all gone. No wonder he wrote the Song of Sorrow. In Psalm chapter 142, verse 1, it says, I cry out to the Lord with my voice. With my voice to the Lord, I make my supplications. I pour out my complaint before him. I declare before him my trouble. When my spirit was overwhelmed within me, then you knew my path. In the way in which I walk, they have secretly set a snare for me. If you remember, they were trying to get David at his house when he was at home. They were going to set a trap for him. But his wife assisted him, and he went out the window. Look on my right hand and see, for there is no one who acknowledges me. Refuge has failed me. No one cares for my soul. I cry out to you, O Lord. I said, you are my refuge, my portion in the land of the living. There was no one else in the land of living here that can help David. Nobody he can lean on. He is totally dependent upon God. And he says, attend to my cry, for I am brought very low. Deliver me from my persecutors, for they are stronger than I. Remember, he is the giant killer. He is the one that killed 10,000 of the Philistines. And now he's saying, they're greater than I am. Bring my soul out of prison that I may praise your name. Oh, notice this. Don't miss this. Bring my soul out of prison that I may praise your name. No doubt he wanted the pain to end. No doubt he wanted some relief. He wanted to live in safety. He wanted to live in rest. But that wasn't the reason he gave for this rescue. He said, bring my soul out of prison. Why? That I may praise your name. The righteous shall surround me, for you shall deal bountifully with me. Whenever people start seeing you working in my life, whenever they start seeing you working through my circumstances, they're going to come to me. They're going to flock to me. They're going to surround me. That's the way David felt as a cave dweller. I don't know of anyone on earth who cares for my soul. I'm brought very low. Deliver me, Lord, he's saying. You can feel the loneliness of his desperate circumstances. This is a cave. You can feel David's despair, the depths to which his life has sunk. There's nothing left, no escape, nothing. Hopelessness and helplessness are all he feels. He goes from the mountaintop giant killer to the rock bottom, lonely, scared cave dweller. Yet during all of this, David had not lost sight of God. He has not lost sight of God. You see, sometimes whenever we get in our circumstances and we look around and we say, God, I need you to do this in my life. God, I want you to do this in my life. Whenever God doesn't perform the way we think he should be performing in our lives, what do we do sometimes? Well, then I'm just not going to go to church then. I'm just not going to go be with God anymore. I'm just going to do my own thing. I'm no longer going to do anything for the Lord anymore. I'm not going to live for him anymore. But David was able to work through his circumstances, and through those circumstances, he never lost sight of God. He cries out to the Lord to deliver him. And here is where we catch sight of the very heart of the man, the inward place that only God truly sees, that inward unseen quality that God saw when he chose to anoint this young shepherd boy from Bethlehem to start with. Notice the challenge. And what it involved. David had been brought to the place where God can truly begin to shape him and to use him. And when the sovereign God begins to bring us to nothing, it is to reroute our lives, not to end them. To reroute our lives. Human perspective says, you've lost this, you've lost that, you've caused this, you've caused that, you've ruined this, you've ruined that. You might as well just end your life. Life is not worth living. Remember Job's wife? Whenever all the bad things were happening in his life, his wife said, "Won't you just curse God and die? Just get it over with." But God says, No. Hang on. You're living in a cave. You're in a cave right now, but that doesn't mean it's curtains. It means it's time to reroute your life. It's time to start anew. That's exactly what he does with David. David didn't text a friend. He didn't go on social media and advertise his situation to the world and say, "Look at what's happening in my life. Woe is me." He didn't place an ad in the newspaper saying, hey, look, everybody see what's happening in my life. He didn't go start a GoFundMe page. He didn't advertise to anyone else because really there was no one else to advertise to, only to God. God was the only one who could do anything about it. He alone is in a cave with David. No one else for David to lean on but God. And I want you to see here this morning, look at what God did. Look at what God did. He begins to reroute his life. Things begin to start changing in the life of David now. Now that he's totally reliant upon God. Look who comes to him. First of all, we see the domestic relations. In 1 Samuel chapter 22, verse 1, it says, "David therefore departed from there and escaped to the cave of Adullam. So when his brothers and all of his father's house heard of it, they went down there to him." Remember, it hasn't been that long since David's family didn't really pay much of attention to him. His own father almost forgot about his existence whenever Samuel came and said, "Hey, I'm looking for a possible candidate for kingship. Bring me your sons." And he was like, "No, I've gone through all the sons. There's nobody here. You have any other kids?" "Oh, yeah, they've got one out in the field. He's out there with the sheep." "Well, go get him." And then God anointed him. And then later on, when he went to the battle to take up arms against Goliath, his brother was putting him down. He was saying, "Is there not a cause? Is there no one that'll go and fight this guy?" And his brothers were offended by that because they too were scared. And they're like, "Oh, we know why you're really here. You just want to be seen." His family hasn't been very supportive of him up to this point. But here he is broken. He's at the end, without crutches, crushed in spirit, crying out to God. And would you look at who comes to him? Those same brothers and their father, along with the rest of his household. It's possible that maybe Saul's anger is now spilled over to them and they were in need of escape themselves, and so they joined David, possibly. Sometimes when you're in a cave, you don't want others around you. Sometimes you just can't stand being around people. You hate to admit it publicly. In fact, you usually don't, but it's true. Sometimes you just want to be alone and have a feeling that at this moment, maybe David in his life, this cave dweller, he wanted to be alone. He didn't want anybody to be around him. Because if his life is not worth anything to himself, he didn't see the worth to anyone else. David didn't want his family, but they came. He didn't want them there, but God brought them anyway. And you know what they did? They crawled right into that cave right along with him. You got any friends like that? You got some friends like that that when you don't see your need for them, you got some heartaches and things going on in your life that they're willing to come alongside and say, "I know you don't want me here, I know you don't want to hear this, but I'm not going anywhere. And they just sort of crawl right in that cave with you. It's a great friend that'll do that. But look here. They weren't the only ones. They weren't the only ones. Look in verse 2. And everyone who was in distress, everyone who was in debt, everyone who was discontented gathered to him. So he became captain over them. And there were about 400 men with him. We have the distressed. Everyone who was in distress came. The Hebrew word here, matzok, means not only in distress, but also under pressure, under stress. Have you ever gone into one of those cave tours and you found yourself in one of those little narrow, confined spaces and you sort of kind of work your way through, and then if you breathe wrong, you kind of get stuck, and then you're like, uh-oh, I'm in trouble. And you have that panic sets in, you know. Well, some people feel that in their life as well whenever they're in situations and they start to feel the squeeze. These people here were feeling the squeeze. So here came hundreds of people under pressure. Probably this was a result of Saul's leadership. He is making these irrational demands upon the people because of his delusions, and David is no longer there to tame that beast, that evil spirit within Saul with his harp, and so the people can no longer live under his leadership, and they begin to look for another, and they must be pretty desperate to go and look for one who is hiding out in a cave. But then you have the debtors. Everyone who was in debt made their way there. The Hebrew word here, nasha, means to lean on interest, to have a number of creditors. So these people were the ones who couldn't pay their bills. They were in debt up to their eyeballs, and Israel was putting their brethren in slavery because they couldn't pay their debts, which was against God's law. They were not to charge their poor brethren interest on loans. So it's possible that these people have maybe lost their lands, maybe they lost their homes, and they've been taken away from them, and they couldn't pay their debts. But also you have the discontent. Everyone who is discontented. The Hebrew here, mara nefesh, means to be in bitterness of soul, to have been wronged and mistreated. Well, that group came too. So what does all this mean? Misery loves company. Maybe. That might be part of it. But what's going on here is the land was aching under the rule of Saul. He had overtaxed the people. He had mistreated them. He was a madman given to intense depression. And they were all suffering the consequences, and they just couldn't take it anymore. So David ended up with a cave full of dissidents. Can you imagine that? I mean, it's bad enough to be there alone, feeling like a worm. But now you got over 400 worms crawling around in there with you. What a mess. But God was working. God was working there. He was rerouting David's life. Sure, this man is in a cave. Sure, he feels worthless. He feels useless. He feels mistreated. He feels misunderstood. That's why he's in a cave. But before he can split, his brethren come. The rest of his family come. And then before he could find a space for them to sit down, all these strangers of all sorts begin to drop in. Listen, I don't know how the world was traveling at that time, but before long, there were over 400 fellow cave dwellers all looking to him as their leader. The cave was no longer David's escape hatch. It became the starting point for David's kingdom. If you can believe it, that smelly, dank cave became a place of training for those who were the beginning of the army that would eventually be called David's mighty army of men of valor. That's right. This motley crew would become his mighty men of battle. And later, they would become his cabinet when he took office. He turned their lives around and instilled in them order and discipline and character and direction. David was beaten all the way down until there was no way but to look up. And when he looked up, God was there, bringing this bunch of unknown rejects to him little by little, until finally they proved themselves to be the mightiest men of Israel. Wow, how awesome is that? I love this story. What a turning point in David's life when he made that crucial decision not to walk away, not to give up. He would accept his situation and he would make the best of it. Even if it was in a cave, so be it. And if those around him, they needed leadership, well, then he was going to provide it. Who would have ever guessed that the next king of Israel was training his troops in a dark cave where nobody saw and nobody cared? How unusual of God, yet how carefully he planned it. David became a sort of a Robin Hood. His Sherwood Hills would be the rugged Judean wilderness with its mountain and caves and deep valleys. There he commanded a group of mavericks because God wanted him to become a maverick king. Maybe this is where they got the idea of Robin Hood from. I don't know. Israel would never see another king like David. We looked at Psalm 142, but David also wrote Psalm 57 and Psalm 34. The book of Psalms is not in chronological order in our Bible. It's organized more by themes and musical, liturgical use rather than by date. So we don't know in what order he wrote these, but looking at his life, it seems to be fit in sort of a backwards order, if you will. 142, when he was at his lowest moment in life. Then Psalm 57, when he was on his knees, and then finally Psalm 34, when he was on his feet. Notice in Psalm 57, it's titled The Mitchum of David when he fled from Saul into the cave. The descriptive line at the beginning of many of these psalms sort of give us an idea of the author and the context. In Psalm 57, verse 1, it says, "Be merciful to me, O God. Be merciful to me, for my soul trusts in you, and in the shadow of your wings I will make my refuge until these calamities have passed by." Don't miss that. Don't miss that. I know sometimes whenever bad things happen into our lives, we sort of making the thing a debate with God, saying, "God, if you allow these things to get out of my life, Lord, if you allow these things to pass by, then I'll trust in you, then I'll come back to you." Look at what David's doing here. He's saying, "Hey, no matter, even though I'm in a cave, no matter what's happened, I'm going to be under your wing. I'm going to be under your refuge until the calamities pass by." Sometimes we get it back to front. "I will cry out to the God," notice this, "Most High." What is he doing here? He's getting his understanding of who his God is. He serves a God that is Most High. He's putting God in his proper perspective here. He's putting God in his proper place. "To God who performed all things for me, he shall send from heaven and save me. He reproaches the one who would swallow me up, Selah. God shall send forth his mercy and his truth." At this point, David is on his knees. He's still down, but at least he's looking up. He's no longer looking within. He's no longer whinging about his things that are happening in his life anymore. Notice verse 4, "My soul was among the lions. I lie among the sons of men who are set on fire, whose teeth are spears and arrows, and their tongues are sharp swords. He is hiding in the cave. Saul's men are out there trying to pursue him. They are relentless in their hunt. Their hatred burns within them, and he's familiar with the spear of Saul, if you remember. Saul tried to kill him. His wife has lied about him." And so David says to God in verse 5, "Be exalted, O God, above the heavens. Let your glory be above all the earth." And then in verse 7, "My heart is steadfast, O God. My heart is steadfast. I will sing and I will give praises." Look at verse 11. "Be exalted, O God, above the heavens. Let your glory be above all the earth." We see where David's eyes are now, don't we? Can you see that? "Oh God, you be exalted." In Psalm 142, he's saying, "I'm in a cave. I'm at the end. There's no one on my right hand. There's no one on my left hand. Nobody cares about me. And then and now in Psalms chapter 57, he says, be gracious to me, God. I am stretched. I'm being pulled beyond my limits, and I need you to meet my needs. He's crying out with his declaration of dependence. Maybe some of you need to do that here this morning. Maybe your circumstances are such that you can't handle it. And maybe here this morning, you need to cry out a declaration of dependence. Oh, God, I'm dependent upon you. Now look in verse 34. Psalm 34, he says, I believe this is the third psalm that he wrote while he was in the cave, though it may be a different cave here. He says in verse 1, I will bless the Lord at all times. His praises shall continually be in my mouth. What a difference. What a change has overcome David. Later, we learned that David's men became experts with the sword and with the bow and with the arrow, and they learned how to get their act together in battle. They developed discipline in the ranks. They may have been mavericks, but they are now on their way of becoming skilled hunters and courageous fighters. And so David, seeing his men marching in step, using the sword and the spear and the bow with skill, he goes and says to them in verse 3, "Oh, magnify the Lord with me, and let us exalt his name together." You see what David's doing here? He has put his eyes on the Lord, and now he is gathering his men and his army together. He's saying, hey, listen, I want you to put your eyes upon the Lord. Don't put them on me. You put them on the Lord. And in verse 4, he says, I sought the Lord, and he heard me, and he delivered me from all my fears. David's been running around, fearful of his life. And now you see the place where he's at. He is no longer fearful. God has delivered him from all my fears. To the distressed among the group, he says in verse 8, oh, and taste and see that the Lord is good. Blessed is the man who trusts in him. To those who are in debt, he says in verse 9, oh, fear the Lord, you saints. There is no want to those who fear him. And to the discontented, he says in verse 10, oh, fear the Lord, you his saints. There is no one in him. Verse 10, you young lions, and the young lions suffer hunger. They lack and they suffer hunger. But those who seek the Lord shall not lack any good thing. And then finally, he gives up a sort of a wrap-up here with this lesson with the entire groups. In verse 19, he says, many are the afflictions of the righteous. Even the righteous end up sometimes in these dark, damp, lonely caves. And even in those situations, he says, many are afflicted of the righteousness. But watch this next verse. But the Lord delivers him out of them all. Are you seeing the change that's happening in the life of David here? Are you seeing his spirits lifted? The change, why did it occur? Why do you see such a major change take place in David's life and attitude? Let me share a couple of thoughts with you here. First of all, it's because David hurt enough to admit his need. David hurt enough to admit his need. When you are hurting, you need to declare it to someone, especially to the Lord. David hurt enough to admit his need. We live in a culture that believes it's acceptable to hide in hurts. In fact, whenever we try to confront people who are obviously hurting, oftentimes we get pushed aside and we get shut down and they don't want to talk to us. They don't want to communicate to us. They come to believe this idea that we should suffer in silence. But until we are willing to be vulnerable and willing to share our hurt with others, we will have very little difficult time to be able to move forward in our lives. David hurt enough to admit his need. Secondly, he was honest enough to cry for help. We live under such a veneer for so long in our generation that we hardly know how to cry for help anymore. In fact, whenever I was growing up, it was kind of a sign of weakness. Never let them see you cry. But God honors such vulnerability. He did it then and he does it now. And the third thing we see here is he was humble enough to learn from God. He was humble enough to learn from God. How tragic it is that we live in one cave after another, after another, after another, and we never learn our lesson. We never learn our lesson from God. But that's not the case with David. I love this man's utter humility here. If it is going to be in a cave, well then, you know what? Let's not fight it. We will turn it into a training ground for the future. And as I look at this time in David's life, I cannot help but reflect upon Jesus who is coming in the glories of heaven one day in order to accept a whole body of troublemakers and sinners like us. And I look forward to that day. Some of us are living in some emotional cave right now where it's dark and dismal and damp and delusional, and it may have even been of our own making. Perhaps the hardest part of all this is that we cannot declare the truth to anyone else because we are so desperate, we're so lonely. I weary of the philosophy that the Christian life is just one silver lining cloud after another, and we're just kind of soaring over it. It's not. Sometimes the Christian life includes a deep, dark cave, if we're honest. Remember we said before, the conversion of a soul is the miracle of a moment, but the making of a saint is the task of a lifetime. And God isn't about to give up, even when you're in such a cave. He's not through, even though you're the lowest you've ever been in your life. And sometimes life feels like a dry, barren wind off a lonely desert, and sometimes inside of us we just begin to wilt. At other times, it feels more like a chilling mist seeping through our pores, and it numbs our spirit, and the fog that is there before us prevents us from being able to see beyond just a few meters. What is it about discouragement that strips our lives of joy and leaves us feeling vulnerable and exposed? Well, I don't know all the reasons. I don't even probably know most of the reasons, but I do know one reason. One reason is we don't have a refuge. Think about that. Shelters are hard to come by these days, yet we all need harbors to pull into when we feel weather-worn and we've been blasted by the storm. One writer, he puts it this way. He says, the neighborhood bar is possibly the best counterfeit for the Christian fellowship Christ wants to give His church. It's an imitation, dispensing liquor instead of grace, escape rather than reality, but it is a permissive, accepting, and inclusive fellowship. It is unshockable. It is democratic. You can tell people secrets and they usually don't tell others or even want to. The bar flourishes not because most people are alcoholics, but because God has put into the human heart the desire to know and to be known, to love and to be loved. And so many people seek counterfeit at the price of a few beers. With all my heart, I believe that Christ wants His church to be a fellowship where people can come in and just say, I'm sunk, I'm beat, I've had it. Now let me get painfully specific here with you this morning. Where do you turn when the bottom drops out of your life? Or when you face an issue that is embarrassing, maybe even scandalous? When you discover your son is a practicing homosexual, where do you go? Your mate is talking about a separation or divorce. Your daughter has run away for the fourth time. And this time you're afraid that she's pregnant. How about when you've lost your job and it's your fault? Or financially, you've blown it. Where do you go when your parent is an alcoholic? Or you find out your wife's been having an affair? Where do you turn when you flunked the exam and you've messed up the interview? Where do you turn when you're tossed into jail because you broke a few laws? You need a shelter. A listener, someone who understands you need a cave to duck into. Who will you turn to when there's no one else to tell your troubles to? Where do you find encouragement? David was just such a man. And he turned to the living God and he found in him a place to rest and repair. Cornered and bruised by adversaries, struggling with discouragement and despair, he wrote these words in his journal of woes in Psalm chapter 31, verse 3. He says, "For you are my rock, my fortress. Therefore, for your name's sake, lead me and guide me." Failing in strength and wounded in spirit, David cries out for his need of refuge. The Hebrew term there speaks of a protective place, a place of safety and security and secrecy. He tells the Lord that he, Jehovah God, has become his refuge. In him, the troubled man found encouragement. And now we have the final, all-important question for us here today. Why do you need a refuge? As I read through another psalm in Psalm 31, I find at least three reasons or three answers to this question. In verse 9, he says, "Have mercy on me. Have mercy on me, O Lord, for I am troubled. My eyes waste away with grief. Yes, my soul and my body." First of all, we need refuge because we are in distress, and sorrow accompanies us. You know those feelings, don't you, when your eyes get red from weeping and the heavy weights of sorrow press down upon you. Depression, that serpent of despair, slithers silently through your soul's back door. That's when you need a refuge. And then look at verse 10. He says, "For my life is spent with grief and my years with sighing. My strength fails because of," notice this, "my iniquity, and my bones waste away." We also need refuge because we are sinful and guilt accuses us. You know, there's a lot of pain woven through those words, a lot of embarrassment there even. The feelings like, "It's my fault." What tough words to choke out. "I'm to blame." Distraught and haunted by self-inflicted sorrow, we desperately search for a place to hide. But perhaps the most devastating blow of all is dealt by others. And that brings us to our third reason we need a refuge. In verse 11, it says, "I am a reproach among all my enemies, but especially among my neighbors, those who are supposed to be closest to me, those who are supposed to help me out. And I'm repulsed to my acquaintances, those close friends of ours that we hope would be there for us." Now he becomes repulsed to them. He's repulsive to them. Those who see me outside, they flee from me. And I am forgotten like a dead man, out of mind. They avoid him. They want nothing to do with him. It says, "I am a broken vessel." Once a vessel has been broken here, it's not used by its intended purpose. "I am a broken vessel, for I hear the slander of many." You hear the gossip, the talk of others, fear on every side. "While they take counsel together against me, they scheme to take away my life." This brings us to our third one, is that we need a refuge because we are surrounded by adversities, adversaries, and misunderstandings assault us. Tortured by the whispering of others, we feel like a wounded mouse in the paws of a hungry cat. The thoughts of what people are saying is more than we can bear. I mean, just think about the word gossip. Gossip. I mean, even the name hisses, gossip. Horrible. Gives a final shove as we strive for survival on the ragged edge of despair. It just kind of sends us over the edge. Discouraged people don't need critics. They're hurt enough already. They don't need more guilt or piled on distress. They need encouragement. And a word, they need a refuge. A place to hide and heal. A willing and caring, available someone, a confidant, a comrade in arms. And maybe you're here to say, "I can't find one." Well, why not share David's shelter? The one he called my strength.
my mighty rock, my fortress, my stronghold, my high tower. We know him today by another name. His name is Jesus. He is still available even to the cave dwellers among us. Lonely people needing someone to care. How many of us have lost our crutches? How many of us have had our crutches knocked out from underneath us? You feel all alone in a cave, maybe even one that you've created yourself. Haven Baptist Church is our name. But is that who we really are? The word haven means refuge, a safe place, a shelter, a sanctuary. Of all the places in our community where one can find a safe haven, it should be at Haven Baptist Church. If not, well then, for heaven's sakes, let's take the name off the church. Or better yet, why don't we live up to our name? Why don't we live up to our name? Why don't we become a safe haven for those in our community? And it is at Haven Baptist Church that we, like David, should point people in need to Jesus, our refuge, our rock, our shelter, our stronghold. No matter what cave you might find yourself in, our hope is in Jesus. And if you don't have that hope here this morning, boy, I would love to have a chat with you after the service. Please come and talk to me. I'd love to have a chat with you, or maybe we can set up an appointment together, or I can come and I can share with you the hope of Jesus that I have. If you have found yourself in a cave, look up. Look up. God brought David out of his cave and eventually he became king. Allow God to work in your life. Allow him to bring people into your life who can assist you in your time of need. And be open and be honest with God and cry out to him. And when you do, don't be surprised if you're still in a cave, but you're in that cave giving your praise to him and trusting in him to fully see you through. We got any cave dwellers here this morning? But I want you to know there's hope for you. There's hope for you. Let's go to the Lord and pray. Heavenly Father, we thank you for your word. We thank you for the life of David. And Lord, I thank you for the transparency and I thank you for the honesty that we see in Scripture. And Lord, you don't hold back. You don't just sugarcoat everything. You don't make everything look all nice and wonderful. But even as we go through the pain and we see all that David went through, Lord, I pray that that would be a hope for some of us here today. Because, Lord, maybe we're at the rock bottom. Maybe we're lying flat on our backs and we have no place to look but up. But I pray, God, that you would open up our eyes and help us to see you there. And then, Lord, as you begin to reroute our lives, Lord, I pray that we too will be able to begin to praise you, Lord, for who you are. And thank you, Lord, for working in our lives and our hearts. And we ask it all in Jesus' name we do pray. Amen.